Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on the en banc conferences scheduled today is William Keck v. State, case number 61675. Mr. Westbrook, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court, Mr. Chief Justice, my name is David Westbrook. At counsel table with me is Deborah Westbrook, co-author of the brief. It's our pleasure to represent Mr. Keck today. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal in this case, if I may. I'd like to start out addressing the Batson issue in this case. I think this is dispositive of the entire case, and it demands a new trial. And I'd like to start it by reading a quote directly from one of the district attorneys in this case. The district attorney is talking to Ms. Jones, a black female juror who the state later struck. This is during voir dire. I'll read your answer to number 30 because I think it really illustrates what we are looking for in every juror here. It says this: I do not have a hard and fast rule regarding the death penalty. I believe there are cases that are so horrible it should definitely be considered. Based on the circumstances, I could consider the death penalty. Is that kind of accurately reflecting your mindset about it? Ms. Jones answers, yes. Mr. Daskus answers, perfect. Later on in this case, the state would strike Ms. Jones, and the reasons given were her perfect answers. These reasons were actually pretextual. Ms. Jones was struck, along with Ms. Henderson, the only other black female juror on the panel, because she was a black female. And an analysis...
Mr. Westbrook, which one fell asleep?
Neither one of them fell asleep, Your Honor.
So that's a misrepresentation in the record?
It is, Your Honor.
And what do we do, notwithstanding what you're telling us about what the state did, or what I anticipate you're going to tell us about what the state did, or what happened in the district court with respect to the Batson challenge? Doesn't the timing of that challenge make a significant difference in what you're asking us to do here today, in that it was not made before the jury was sworn?
Yes, it wasn't made before the jury was sworn, so therefore it was timely.
It was or was not?
It was made before the jury was sworn, therefore it was timely. There were three bench conferences in this case, and that brings up a very important issue that I'm glad that the court is addressing here. Rule 250 requires us to record these things. In this particular district court, bench conferences are not recorded. That was a large issue. We even went back for a brief evidentiary hearing regarding that issue in this case. The process at trial was when there was an issue to discuss at the bench, the parties went to the bench and then made a record afterwards. The Batson challenges in this case occurred following a conference at the bench. We do not have a record at the trial court about exactly what was said at the bench. However, that certainly shouldn't be held against Mr. Keck, whose attorney did not know that the courtroom was not recording as required by Rule 250.
Counsel, wasn't there some type of notices on the door in terms of how that courtroom was handled?
There was a notice on the door that said, this is a reporting department, not a recording department. However, there was nothing that said that bench conferences were not reported. There was nothing that said that Rule 250 wasn't being followed. There was no colloquy on the record, and there certainly was no waiver by Mr. Keck of his right to have an open trial and his right to have it recorded.
But notwithstanding the fact that there was someone in that courtroom doing this.
There was someone in the courtroom typing.
Yeah.
That was the pantomime was the typing. Yes, there was someone in the courtroom doing that. However, Judge Tagliati has the exact same situation, if I recall correctly. No, I'm sorry, I strike that. She does not. However, there are other courtrooms that actually have a transcriptionist who records bench conferences, either with an earpiece or later on by reviewing the jabs. I mean, in fact, we all know...
But is there anything other than the... nobody moved to remand to clarify what occurred on the bench conferences that were not recorded. There's a procedure where you can stipulate to try to recreate a record that was not created originally in our rules of appellate procedure. And it struck me as I was reading this record that we really don't have anything concrete to suggest that indeed was the subject of the off-the-record bench conferences, other than you're saying it in your briefs. And that's troubling to me. I don't know why you wouldn't have pursued that kind of an appellate.
There's two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, we know that the Batson issues happened before the jury was sworn. It's on the record, and whether or not it was discussed at the bench conference, I don't believe that it's material. Regardless, the Batson issue was accepted as timely by the court. There was no objection by the state to the timeliness of the Batson issue down at the trial level. So there
was no substance discussed at the bench conference regarding the Batson issues, which you're telling me. So why is it significant that whatever you discussed was recorded? And then you didn't challenge it later.
Well,
based on Batson.
I see, Your Honor. First of all, the only significance would be if this court were to decide that there wasn't some kind of a timely objection made. And then the problem would be that the court didn't record as the court was supposed to record. And as far as recreating the record, and I want to get back to your question about that, because that's very important. I discussed this with our attorneys. Our attorneys didn't have enough of a recollection about what occurred at the three bench conferences that happened prior to the Batson challenge in order to recreate that record. And the state certainly didn't try to recreate the record either, but what's important in telling about this is that there was no timeliness objection down below. If the state, the best way for the state to have responded to this, if they were concerned, would have been a timeliness objection, because certainly on the merits of a Batson challenge, they lose, and they lose every single time because there were pretextual reasons for these strikes.
Well, let's assume that we get past the timeliness of the purported Batson challenge. What do we do about the fact that, and I know that you were not trial counsel, but when the state offered what they are supposed to do, and that is a race-neutral reason for the challenge, and the opportunity or the burden then shifted to defense counsel to say why that race-neutral reason wasn't correct, it appears as if the record shows the defense counsel responding, "No questions at this time." In fact, the exec quote was, "Not at this time." What do we do about that? Did we get all the way through a proper Batson below?
We did get through the proper Batson, Your Honor, because a prima facie case was made. It was accepted by the court as timely. There were no objections to the prima facie case. And, in fact, the state then offered its race-neutral reasons. After that,
defense counsel, and I share what Justice Sata said. I know you were not trial counsel, but it doesn't matter. There was no traverse, no argument that that was a pretextual, ostensible race-neutral reason that the state gave. There was no record made of it, of a reason for it on any kind of comparative analysis. There's just nothing more in that record past that, is there?
Your Honor, best practice, obviously, would have been to go into the kind of detail that we went into this brief. That would be best practice. However, we submitted on the record at that point, and the record included sufficient proof, more than sufficient proof, of the fact that this was pretextual and that the race-neutral reasons didn't hold water. On the traverse issue, the evidence...
We don't have a district court finding of whether that's true or not.
The district court, obviously, the district court denied our Batson challenges.
Well, but you didn't make an argument that it was pretextual. You seem... Not you, but the...
I understand what you mean, Judge.
You seem
it's
to...
It's still me. I'm the public defender.
Yes. You seem to act... The defense seemed to acquiesce in the district court's acceptance of the race-neutral reason proffered by the state, even if it was pretextual. There was no, "Your Honor, that's wrong. That can't be true. You know, the juror wasn't sleeping," whatever it was.
Well, there was actually a colloquy on the juror sleeping.
Right, and that's
the accusation was that Ms. Henderson was sleeping, and the court specifically did not find that was the case. And
so the court found that her eyes were closed or something.
Yeah, he said her eyes were closed at some point. Of course, the court's main problem was there was no contemporaneous objection. The state never pointed that out until they got into a situation where they needed a race-neutral reason, and they pulled that out.
Fair enough.
Counsel, you mentioned it would be best practices for the defense to traverse the race-neutral explanation. In Connor, this court said that you bear the burden to demonstrate that the prosecution's facially race-neutral explanation for its peremptory strike was pretextual. In Connor, we said the defense has the responsibility, as the third prong explained in Hawkins, to traverse the race-neutral explanation. And as my colleagues have questioned, there's simply nothing in the record on that point. Doesn't that render your Batson argument over?
It does not, Your Honor, and here's why. Defense attorneys simply cannot waive this type of a structural error, and it certainly can't be done without some kind of colloquy with the defense. This is a structural constitutional error. If it was anything else, Your Honor, absolutely, we'd be in big trouble here. That said, we fully admit that this was not remotely close to best practice as far as the diverse goes, and frankly, it would bring up
the same best practices.
I mean, it should
I
happen.
Want to suggest to you that in Connor we said it's an element to a successful Batson error finding. And in the absence of the fulfillment of the element, it would seem that you have failed to show a Batson error.
And, Your Honor, I don't think that was the actual holding of Connor, but I do know exactly what you're talking about. The problem with that being a holding is that it would preclude plain error analysis, which can't be done. There is enough evidence in this record to show pretext. And there's only two choices. Either we do a plain error analysis here and actually analyze the state's reasoning for their challenges under a plain error standard, or you're going to have your hands full come Sixth Amendment PCR time.
So what's your plain error analysis, assuming that the court agreed that that even exists after Connor?
We are in an excellent position in this case that we wouldn't be in most cases. First of all, we had a long and involved voir dire process. Some of them are quick. This one was not. Second of all, most importantly, we actually have detailed jury sheets, which means that going into this traverse, the district court below had far more information than is normally available. And having that information in front of the court, whether or not we put it forward in oral argument, is immaterial because the information to make the correct decision was there. Now, I agree, and I'm sure that the attorneys who tried this case, if they were here, would absolutely admit that they should have traversed effectively. And that did not happen. However, that
we're suggesting that on appeal, we should undertake that analysis. So what is the evidence that you would have argued or had your colleagues argue to the district court that you're now arguing to us that makes it so clear that the race-neutral explanation was pretextual?
This is what makes it clear, and I believe that the Ford case is directly on point in this, is that the state's justifications were implausible and fantastical when you review what they said at the beginning during voir dire, then their stated reasons, and then what they said again in closing argument. In striking Ms. Henderson, and particularly in striking Ms. Jones, all the state did was wave to the jurors about what a model juror Ms. Jones was. They complimented Ms. Henderson, but they raved about Ms. Jones and how her answers were perfect. That was the exact word used, perfect. And then the state turned around and took those same answers and said, these are a basis for us to strike Ms. Jones. And where the analysis comes in is twofold. Number one, take a look at what the state said. It reminds me of Janus, the two-faced god of Greek mythology in some ways, because at the beginning we're talking about how her answers, Ms. Jones's answers, illustrate the perfect death penalty juror. And then when giving their reason to the court, this is what is said. So our concern is that for this juror, even in a situation involving one of her own relatives, she was at least skeptical about the decision to seek death. She showed no skepticism. What she showed was a perfect answer. But now this very answer is being said, well, she's skeptical. And then in closing, the state or the jury was specifically told to think back to jury selection, and Ms. Jones was specifically referenced, you know, as giving model answers in this case. So the state's own words demonstrate pretext, but it becomes abundantly clear once you take a look at the other non-black female jurors who remained on the panel with the state's blessings. The two reasons given for striking Ms. Jones, and Ms. Henderson is just as egregious a case. It's just I think Ms. Jones was a model juror in every way, and the state actually admits that she was a model juror in every way. So I want to concentrate on her because of the shortness of an argument. The thing they said about Ms. Jones is, number one, she had a relative who was murdered a long time ago. Initially, she wanted to seek the death penalty, just like everybody else. She was angry. But then the more she analyzed the case, she realized it wasn't so simple. And ultimately, after analyzing it, she felt maybe death wasn't appropriate. That was the entire content of what happened to her. And that was used to say that she might be skeptical about the death penalty, something she never said, and that she might be skeptical of police, something she never said. Compare that to Linda Young. Linda Young, not a black female, also said she was cautious about applying the death penalty. She actually said she was skeptical of the police because her youngest brother, and this is a quote from her, was falsely accused by a sheriff of being responsible for a fatal accident where a police officer was killed. She specifically said, the sheriff treated one of my brothers unfairly when he falsely accused him before knowing the facts. Also, unlike Ms. Jones, Ms. Young specifically talked about her difficulty in imposing the death penalty. Ms. Jones said she'd take it seriously. She never said it would be difficult to impose. Ms. Young, on the other hand, said, I think I could impose the death penalty, but I'm also a very sensitive person and it could be tough. She mentioned that her church opposes the death penalty, although she doesn't always follow everything that her church says. And she said specifically, it would be difficult, but I could do it. The only difference between Linda Young, except that Linda Young seems to me that she'd be more disinclined to vote for death. The only difference between the two of them is that one is a black female, and the state struck her, and one is not a black female, and the state kept her. The state has never explained Linda Young, not in their brief, certainly not during their race neutral explanations at trial. And it's too late to do it now under Connor specifically and Watson. Okay? They can't explain it because it's absolute proof that the juror who remained was similarly situated to the juror who was kicked, and the only difference exposes the reason why she was struck. The state struck her for being a black female, plain and simple.
Would it be unfair of us to assume that this could have been before us in a proper way, as you suggest, since they can't explain it now, if everyone had done Batson according to the three-point step-by-step analysis that we have talked about is required?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because there's no fourth step in a Batson challenge. I don't think that the state would have been able to respond after the traverse, certainly not by right.
But there was no traverse. There was nothing. Zero.
Well, there was we submitted on the record, Your Honor. There's a big difference. There's a big difference. And I can find the actual quote for rebuttal, Your Honor, but my recollection is that we said we submitted, Your Honor. However, we certainly didn't say we withdraw our Batson challenge. And that would be required in order for this court to rule that the Batson challenge is dead. We would actually have to withdraw the Batson challenge because what we're talking about is a fundamental right that we cannot waive without some kind of traverse, certainly, but a waiver, an actual waiver. It can't be said simply because we did a lousy job on the traverse that we waived a fundamental structural constitutional right. And to say that would be an incredibly dangerous precedent.
But doesn't that render the third element of Batson and Connor and all the other cases that have come since, at least in our jurisprudence, to be without meaning?
It doesn't render it to be without meaning, Your Honor. In this case, we can't ignore the evidence that was there. And the evidence that was there was memorialized in the form of not only an oral voir dire, but also we had jury questionnaires. And the court read them, the state read them, a lot of them out loud to talk about how great Ms. Jones' responses were. They also read the responses of Norma Spenglove out loud, which were very similar. Of course, the state kept Norma Spenglove on the jury because she wasn't a black female, and they struck Ms. Jones and Ms. Henderson for the exact same responses. This court cannot ignore the plainly erroneous decision to allow these challenges when the evidence is staring us all in the face. It can't be done, and to do it would destroy plain error review, and ultimately, it would make a Sixth Amendment analysis on ineffective assistance pretty easy.
The fact is, this court hasn't opined on an approach you're suggesting, which is essentially a comparison. In the absence of a traverse, we would still find Batson error if this court, on its own review of the record, found that the race-neutral explanation was contradicted by other statements in the record by the state.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that the court agreed with that kind of analysis, are there any cases anywhere else in America that have taken that approach?
Taken the approach of reviewing a constitutional structural error de novo? Every case.
No.
I know this. I know that structural constitutional errors can be reviewed.
My
de novo.
Question may have been imprecise.
My understanding
is there any other case in America that accepts the the approach to the third prong of Batson discussed in Connor in the manner in which you suggested? And
yes.
If so, what's the analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a case. Court's indulgence.
Why don't you save that for rebuttal? Let me ask my question.
I will save it for rebuttal. Yes.
And have your associate, your colleague, maybe try to find that case.
Yes.
My colleagues have beat up pretty bad on the failure of the trial attorneys to do what they're supposed to under Batson. Analyze that under Strickland.
I think that the analysis still goes back to plain error, Your Honor. And whether or not we can actually ignore something that's plainly before the court.
But what could have been before the court if there had been a proper traverse?
It was already, the point is, it was already before the court. I mean, it was already before the court.
You're trying to save your colleagues in the public defender's office. Did they screw up on this case?
Yes,
not
Your Honor.
Doing it?
Yes.
I mean, you call it best practices. I call it ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes.
Which we don't handle on appeal in this state for whatever reason.
I like answering direct questions with direct answers, Your Honor. And the answer is yes. The answer is yes.
So analyze it under Strickland, under the Strickland two-prong test, so that when this case, if case we affirm, if it comes back under habeas corpus, post-conviction relief, there'll be a record to say that the appellate counsel said that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Okay. I'm not saying there's ineffective assistance of counsel, Your Honor, because I'm precluded from doing that.
Why?
I'm precluded from doing that for the same reason.
You're an officer of this court.
I am an officer of the court, Your Honor. And if you're asking me my opinion about it, I'm not a judge. Furthermore, I think my colleagues in this case are part of my office. It's my office. Essentially what I'd be doing up here is arguing my own ineffective assistance because there's no difference between me and my colleagues in the office. We're all part of the public defender's office. But analyzing under Strickland or any other standard you want, Your Honor, this is what should have happened. There is obvious evidence that everybody had before them, including the judge, including the district attorney, and including the defense attorneys. In this case, that it was pretextual. That evidence is now before this court. Failure to fully traverse and passionately traverse this case was something that should not have happened. And there's no question whatsoever that if this court ruled because there was no traverse, two things would be happening. Number one, again, it would be horribly damaging to plain error review. But number two, if this court were to rule there was no traverse or was an adequate traverse, and therefore the Batson issue is dead, number one, that would be a new rule. I've never heard of that rule before, and I would ask you not to make it in the middle of my case and apply it to Mr. Kep, because it didn't exist before. Okay, but number two, then I think that the PCR case would be decided, because they should have traversed, and they would be the first to tell you they should have traversed. Okay, I mean, we can't let embarrassment over making a mistake in a trial or the loyalty which I do have to my office and to my colleagues, who I respect greatly. These are two of the best attorneys in our office. It's two of the best attorneys in our office who were involved in this case. And by and large, they did a great job. But the issue here is they should have traversed because the evidence of pretext and of violation of Batson could not be more obvious, particularly when one reviews the transcripts of voir dire and the questionnaires. It's all in there. And when you compare the jurors who were allowed to sit by the state versus the black female jurors who were struck, it couldn't be more obvious. But it's so obvious that the district court should have caught it.
Mr. Westbrook, I want to move you on because you're down to a very short period of time, and I have a specific question about some of the claims that you made regarding the mitigation or aggravating evidence that was presented in the argument made by the district attorney. I am particularly concerned about comments made that you raise under the prosecutorial misconduct part of your appeal, specifically the delivering the bullet and the reference to weddings 15 years in the future. You want to talk about that?
I do, Your Honor. This is textbook golden rule, put yourself in the juror's shoes type of argument. The entire closing argument was structured in order to enrage the jury and make sure that there was no way they were going to let this guy live after what he did.
But isn't that exactly what happened?
That they let him live?
What? No. She asked you a question about delivering the bullet, and isn't that exactly what happened?
That a bullet came out during the surgery? Yes, that is what happened. However, what didn't happen was 15 years in the future, no imaginary wedding took place where an imaginary party guest asked questions of...
So there's really no claim as to misconduct as to the statement about delivering a bullet?
No, Your Honor, I believe it was still inflammatory. And the way in which it was put was grossly inflammatory. Furthermore, the state alleged that the bullet is what caused the death of the unborn quick child, which wasn't even true and accurate, and it was a misrepresentation of the record.
Where does it say in the record that it wasn't true? What was that finding made?
The medical examiner said that there was no evidence that the bullet specifically caused the death of the unborn quick child. In all likelihood, I believe, if the record is clear on this, it was blood loss to the mother and trauma. Now, that's the absolute textbook definition of splitting hairs. The point is the imagery. The point is the intent behind the imagery.
So you're saying cumulatively as part of that argument, it all together was so...
Yes, Your Honor. And I am vastly more concerned about this fictional wedding that the state spent four full pages talking about in closing argument when there's a specific rule against it. And they know very well there's a specific rule against it. This wasn't their first dance.
But didn't the defense set the stage for the wedding discussion a bit, Mr. Banks?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. Mr. Banks, we weren't allowed to quantify reasonable doubt, as we all
know. No, yeah.
So all we can do is say, hey, guys, this is a really important decision. If someone asks you a question later, if you're at a party or if you're talking to a school or if you're at a wedding or some other event, someone asks you a question, you have to be comfortable with the decision you made then. Okay, the jury was the person later on at some fictional event. It didn't have to be a wedding. It could have been anything. The word wedding was uttered, but the context was totally different. The state began setting up this closing argument with this fictional wedding way back during the direct examination of the victim's mother. Okay, bringing in pictures of holidays and asking her, what's his favorite holiday, Halloween? So the idea that somehow, because Mr. Banks said the word wedding, that opened the door is ridiculous because the state was setting this up all the way back in direct.
Also, does our juror office have some responsibility to object? Are they allowed to create invited error by not objecting and then coming in as you're making the arguments today?
Absolutely, they have a responsibility to object. However, constitutional errors of constitutional magnitude...
The question is, are they not guilty of inviting error by sitting there passively? Because as you're sitting today, you know it's error. Why was there no objection put forth at the time?
There should have been an objection, Your Honor, but it shouldn't affect the outcome of this case. Whenever there's a death penalty case, as the court is aware, the law treats certain things as if there were an objection, just because it's a death penalty case.
So we're supposed to walk in or on review. Defense can make no objection. They can come in and make every objection, textbook or not, and stand back and say, well, gee, we didn't make an objection, but you should now consider it.
That's why we're stuck with a plain error standard on so many things, Your Honor, but we should
have... the concern becomes, couldn't it be entirely strategic, then, that you don't object and then come up on appeal and claim error?
It would be the worst strategy I've ever heard of, Your Honor.
I'm not saying it's a good one.
To answer the court's question, it's not strategic at all, because it doesn't help us at all. If the objections were made, we'd be with a vastly improved standard. Nobody would make that strategy. And as far as being at the trial...
We'd have something to review if the objections were made.
Well, the court still has something to review, Your Honor. It's not as good a standard as it would have been. And it certainly was not a strategy to not object.
I don't want to take much of your time because you have little left, but when you sit down and you come back, are there any states that have moved in the direction of Justice Marshall and Batson and Justice Breyer in the more recent cases saying, we're wasting so much time and attention and ink, especially in death penalty cases, on analyzing peremptory challenges, which are kind of elusive anyway? We should just move to for cause challenge in this arena. Has any state gone that direction, is my question.
Your Honor, I'll attempt to research it when we sit down.
Okay. I know it's not in this case. I don't want to take your time up, but it's something the more I listen to this,
I'm not aware.
I think Justice Marshall may have been correct.
But I certainly would caution anything that would take away from the Batson issue, because in this case, black women were struck because they were black women, period. End of story. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Westford. Mr. Pesci, you're ready to go.
Good morning. Justice, my name is Giancarlo Pesci, counsel for the respondent.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with timeliness. Justice Ada, you began with that. Let's go to the actual record. 1374 is the page. And specifically, after the jury was impaneled, the internal quote is page 9. So the transcripts that are originally created that don't have the bait stamp is 9. Line 3, jury panel now sworn in by the clerk. That's page 9, which is on appeal 1374. Go down that same page, Justices, to line 25. Mr. Banks, the state challenged a few jurors, badge number 18, now we're on to page internal 10. Rhonda Henderson, it's really Yolanda, I think that's a typographical error by the recorder. Angela Jones, the court, okay. The defense, Mr. Banks, they are African-American women. They were the only ones on the panel. Batson and his progeny do not turn on my client having been in a protected class. He is entitled to be tried in front of his peers, and I would make a motion for the state to provide race-neutral reasons based on those two challenges on Batson. Not timely. And timeliness matters. You all said it matters. You said so in Connor. You went right to the heart of the issue with the Connor decision. The Connor decision is such that if you accept the appellant's argument, you must reverse yourselves on Connor. Because in Connor,
I hate to derail you, but I'm a little disturbed. Counsel clearly represented that this objection was made prior to the time that the jury was sworn. And I want to know how this controversy kind of percolated. Why is there such a discrepancy here?
Well, our position is that it was not timely. How it is that he argues that it is, I don't know. I assume it's bootstrapping through this concept that there are no records made of prior bench conferences. Everybody knows, and especially these two very seasoned defense attorneys, that in that particular courtroom is a court recorder, a reporter, and that they have to make a record. But what's even more concerning is the district court gave them that opportunity. This is not Connor. Connor, this court said that the district court did not provide the opportunity to traverse. It was so critical to provide that opportunity that incredibly heinous crime was reversed. Because this court said the decision must be made before. And that did not happen in this case. You cannot get past that. This court has made that abundantly clear in Connor. And so to address your first issue, Justice Sotomayor, timing was not done appropriately. But let's go to Connor itself, and specifically the verdict.
Before you do, though, just for a moment, your opposing colleague makes the point, well, the state didn't say anything about timeliness to the district judge, if indeed it was a problem, and from that you may infer that it was actually made before rather than after. At least as I understand his argument. Could you comment on that, please?
Sure. I don't think that inference is a proper inference to say that it was timely. It is on the defense to make their argument. It's not our job to do their job. And they have to do their job. They didn't in this particular case. That doesn't mean that they were ineffective. That doesn't mean we go right to Strickland, Justice Cherry. But we have to look at Connor. We have to look at that burden that this court imposed. And that burden was not carried in this case. Because all that was said as far as the analysis was what I just read. And as your justices have already pointed out, in fact, Justice Sada, there was the opportunity given by Judge Herndon to defense counsel anything to add after both of those jurors. Each time, the response, nothing at this time. And then nothing else below. Now, the benefit that you've even alluded to here is that you could wait and not make an objection, and then have the benefit on appeal of coming up with all these different reasons. But in Connor, you said that analysis has to be made at the time in district court, because we can't traverse their traverse if they don't traverse. I've been told, if I've understood their argument, that I can't even respond as to the other jurors who we treated, according to them, disparately, because we didn't traverse the traverse. That's just not appropriate. In fact, let's look at Angela Jones. And then it was defense counsel's argument that Linda Young was kept and that these two people were the same, except for the color of their skin, intimating that our responses were pretextual, intimating that we were racially discriminating and that we are lying when we give our reasons. But let's look at Ms. Young. On record on appeals 3729, that's her questionnaire. And then her actual testimony, being in court, so I shouldn't say her testimony, I apologize, when we were doing jury selection, starts at page 1069. So in 3734, in the questionnaire of Linda Young, question 31, the question is, how would you best describe your feelings regarding the death penalty? There's A, B, C, D, and E. You're very familiar with this. You've seen this in so many cases. She selected D. Angela Jones did not. In hers, which is 3847, she did not select A, B, C, D, or E. She did write, I can't check a box stating I believe or don't believe. I guess depending on the circumstances, I would be able to rule in favor. So there's a distinction, there's a difference. But let's get even further, because there is the commentary she made about the death penalty during the questioning in court, she being Miss Jones now, in 1146 on the record, in response to questions by Mr. Daskus. She, Miss Jones, who was the subject of a challenge, said, I didn't necessarily feel that the death penalty should have been applied. A lot of people disagreed with me. Now, you just heard a moment ago that she, like everyone else, felt that way. Well, that's not accurate. She talked about her uncle. And amazingly, in this case, these two women both had their uncles murdered. This individual says, during the questioning by the state, that she did not agree. I didn't necessarily feel that the death penalty should have been applied. That gives the state of Nevada great concern that an individual whose own uncle was murdered didn't feel that the death penalty should have been applied. Let's go to Linda Young.
The Kennedy family didn't think that the death penalty should be applied to Sir M.
That's true. But the Kennedys aren't in the jury pool on this
one. I understand.
One, Justice.
You just when you make a statement like that,
I'm trying to make
a response.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I have to put it in the context of these two particular jurors, the potential jurors, and the allegation that we're treating them differently.
Well, this isn't the first time we've been to the rodeo on Batson with the Clark County District Attorney's Office.
That's
and
correct.
And just, I take a look at it and listening to the argument, even though that we were pretty tough on the public defender's office as to ineffective and everything else, I just don't understand knocking these two black women off. I just don't understand why it's so necessary. In these cases, you're so afraid of losing a case that you knocked off African-Americans consistently.
If I've understood you, Justice, I think you're speaking to the fourth prong of analysis that Connor, you authored and you all signed off on, must be done, looking at the historical nature of discrimination. That was not done.
Yeah, but I've been here for 45 years and I've seen it.
And I would
say, have to shut my eyes.
I would say respectfully, I'd ask you to think of a case where myself or Mr. Daskus did something that you, when you were the district court judge over us, thought was inappropriate.
Never.
And so I can only rely on that because we didn't develop that record down below. And I mean that respectfully, Justice. No.
And I do too to you and Mr. Daskus. Thank respect you. Both of you tremendously as prosecutors.
Thank you. Speaking to Ms. Young, page 3734, and to show the distinction between these two women whose uncles were both murdered, she said, when my uncle was murdered, the man was put to death. It's not just that the state sought it, but it was actually carried out. And then she says, I was grateful because of the horrific murder and the grief that our family endured. Therein lies a monumental distinction between these two individuals that has absolutely nothing to do with the color of their skin. It has to do with their personal beliefs in the context of their own family member being murdered. And the distinction between the two of them was why the state of Nevada sought to remove one and the other was kept. And if I could, I'm sorry I'm jumping around and I see my time's going somewhat, but you talked about the bullet, Justice Zeta. And then Justice Perigo, you responded very quickly, factually speaking. Those are the facts. This woman, when she was shot 8 times, the last bullet entered her stomach and her uterus. That bullet that she gave birth to, in essence, hit the uterus. It damaged the placenta. That was the testimony from Dr. Sims, that the placenta was, in fact, damaged. Of course, because it's considered not a life, the coroner says that's the damage to the mother. But clearly, setting aside whether we're going to get into a debate about life or not, there was damage to the very organs of that mother that provides life to that unborn child. And it is factually 100% accurate that this poor woman had to pass that bullet when she had to pass this uterus. I'm sorry, the unborn child from her uterus. Those are the facts. He's stuck with them. He can't get out from underneath them because they're really, really bad for him. That's not the standard. Those are the facts that he must deal with. Now, if I could speak specifically to...
Counsel, while you're there, why don't you continue into the issue as to the wedding.
As to the wedding, thank you. As to the wedding, what I'd like to do is try to put it into context, and Justice Douglas, you really pointed out the crux of the issue. They sat there quietly and didn't do anything, and here's why I believe they did, and if you can look at it, this was
not... Counsel, the why, and I, as I asserted, but why was it necessary to go down that road?
For defense counsel or for the state?
For the state.
Okay. Here's why. Thank you very much. I would direct your honors to the record on appeal 2389. Now, in the briefs, appellant has described this argument by defense counsel, specifically Mr. Banks, as a vanilla hypothetical. Well, let's look at this alleged vanilla hypothetical. And my position, there was nothing vanilla about it. So Mr. Banks starts off his argument, and he is the one who sets up this wedding. It is his argument. Now, this is a death penalty case. Defense counsel is given two opportunities to argue. Mr. Kane has already argued. Mr. Banks was last for the defense. He sets up this argument about a wedding, and he is going back and forth about the conversation that would occur. And he says, then someone says, I had jury duty once. Yeah, a contract guy is going to say, what kind of a case did you sit on? He will say it was a first-degree murder case. And the table is just going to go absolutely silent. Are you serious? Yeah. This is 2389, internal quote, page 62. Somebody is going to say, what did you do? We gave the guy death. And the other people at the table are, no way. Someone is going to say, what did the guy do? Now, here, pay attention to this and ask yourself if this is vanilla and ask yourself if this is the answer to your question as to why the state got up the way they did. Did the guy train for months and months, get pilot license, and drive into a building and kill 3,000 people? You say, no. Having to defend their decision against 9/11. But wait, there's more. Somebody else will say, I got it. Somebody went into a grocery, found a bunch of strangers, and just started killing everybody in sight. Sound familiar? That sounds awfully like Zane Floyd. Random strangers, you say. No, that wasn't it either. So now we've had this jury challenged, putting it up against 9/11 and Zane Floyd. But there's even more. Then somebody is going to say, oh, my word. Did this person kidnap a child and rape them? Kill them? No. That's not the facts of this case either. Now, defense counsel did go into the facts of this particular case and then went on. And in this alleged vanilla argument that they created, they said on now page 2390.
Counsel, was there any objection by the state during this argument?
No.
As that?
No.
Is this a situation where the state is taking the position that, gee, the defense opened the door?
Yes, it is. If you even find that it is a violation, what it was that was done in rebuttal. They went on to say, I have got to believe that you are people here to send some kind of a message. This is defense counsel stuff. And then went on to say, on those occasions when we are looking back, maybe with a son or a daughter, in talking, you are talking about those kind of things that you have done in your life that you are proud of. And kind of things that make you proud. The kind of things that you have done in your life that make a difference. By the way, this is the very last thing before he sits down. I can guarantee you that no one of you, not one of you, is going to look at that son or daughter in the eye and say, I voted to execute a young man. Now, that's not vanilla. And if the state's response is error, it's in response to the error of the hypothetical that was set up specifically by defense counsel. But the state's rebuttal was not error. And here's the reason why it was not error. This court has stated specifically in Hommack, the Payne court, referring to the United States Supreme Court, rectified the imbalance attributable to both to Booth and Gathers, as noted above, by ruling that the state has a legitimate interest in counteracting the mitigating evidence which the defendant is entitled to put in, by reminding the sentencer that just as the murderer should be considered as an individual, so too the victim is an individual whose death represents a unique loss to society and in particular to his family. By turning the victim into a faceless stranger at the penalty phase of a capital trial, Booth deprives the state of the full moral force of its evidence and may prevent the jury from having before it all the information necessary to determine the proper punishment for a first-degree murder.
Counsel, you use a term or you read from there and they talk about mitigation evidence. This clearly is not mitigation evidence. What this tends to be is that area of inflaming passion, something that the rules talk about neither side is really supposed to do. They're supposed to allow the facts to speak for themselves. If we don't look at that colloquy as mitigation and we look at it as passion, which would have been error, then how do we likewise condone the error exhibited by the state inflaming passion?
Well, the response would be that the state's argument was factual. It was based in the facts that were put forth to rebut the mitigation
facts. Was a wedding brought in on fact testimony, or was that only argued in an argument which is not?
It can be inferred from the facts because there was no possibility for the wedding because, in fact, Mr. Lestelle was killed.
Counsel, that is a major stretch. We're not dealing with fiction writing. We are dealing with fact evidence. It is problematic. It always is a concern when, to be very blunt, the state messes up a perfectly good record by getting into an area they just have no business in getting into, because the facts of the case, as heinous as the crime may be, they went out and did what they were supposed to. They brought evidence to the table. Now they're going above and beyond. That's our concern with this area.
I understand that concern. And my response was to try to speak to the factual issue as far as that the decedent and the surviving victim were together and that their marriage could not occur because, in fact, the victim
was... Well, it's hard-pressed because testimony in the record doesn't talk about... I was hard-pressed to find testimony in the record, the word testimony,
correct,
talking about a wedding. There was none. So this is a response, passion versus passion.
It was a response, Your Honor. It was a response to the defense's argument. That is correct. But if the court feels that it was error, it was in response to the error that already brought forth, and then the court would look under its analysis as far as prosecutorial misconduct and harmless error and things of that nature. The position, obviously, is that that is not what occurred here. This is just a response. Trying to go to a different issue.
Could you comment on the Williams Summer issue and how that applies in the context of a jury hearing sentencing as opposed to a judge?
I'm sorry, did you say Summers?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
And the death penalty hearing, to be precise, might be an appropriate exception to Summers or distinction from Summers. They're arguing that we should overrule it,
correct,
and that because the jury is hearing the evidence in a penalty phase, it's more than just routine sentencing. It is an actual contested proceeding that you should have the Confrontation Clause apply to. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. I recognize that Summers is on point, but has the case law nationally moved past it, and should we reevaluate it?
Short answer to your last question, I don't know. As far as reevaluating, I don't think that you should. I think that this court has evaluated and reevaluated multiple times Summers, and has come to the conclusion that hearsay is admissible in the penalty phase. If I remember correctly, and I did not try Summers, Summers was a death penalty case. And so this court has already looked at that issue and made that determination. And to reverse that would be something that this court shouldn't. And in fact, this court has expressed concerns about reversing things and has spoken of stare decisis and how it is very important. In fact, three of you have pointed out, I believe it's in the Hart case, that you have issues with McConnell and how that particular concern, structural error within McConnell, Justice Hardesty wrote this, Justice Perigary and Justice Seda concurred, was something that gave pause and prompted writing it, but that because it is firmly entrenched in this court's jurisprudence, it has not overruled it. When there is structural error in that, according to at least three of you, there is no allegation of structural error within Summers.
So issue of whether Summers is correct under current contemporary law raised in the district court?
And my response is that it is correct. I have to be brutally honest. I don't know about any trends in other courts.
Right, but the issue was not raised in the trial court, or it was raised in the trial court.
In the Keck case?
Yes.
No. I was not objected to a trial.
Okay, so there was no argument the trial court didn't have enough. I mean, the precedent would be mandatory in the trial court, but no, the issue wasn't set up in the trial court that Summers no longer stands.
And here's how I'll try to respond, and hopefully I am for you, Justice. I apologize. What occurred in this case at the trial level was in the penalty phase, the state of Nevada put on evidence which included evidence from Detective Dan Long from Homicide encompassing the appellant's prior criminal history. What the defense did object to, and I got to use the right term, it was the federal paperwork, in essence, regarding the appellant's crime at Lake Mead. And the defense objected to that particular evidence, not the remainder of the evidence, but that particular evidence, and did not articulate or invoke Summers. What they spoke of was the fact that that particular case, the charges stemming from Lake Mead, had not gone to a conviction or a conclusion. And so they said that that evidence was coming in essence, premature, as I think I understood it. So I would say that does not preserve the issue. And I would also say that that is not an appropriate reason to exclude that particular evidence from coming in. There's not a basis or a reason to revisit or change the Summers decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there are any other questions, I'll have
Counsel,
a seat.
Before you sit down, I want to come back to the waiting situation. Only because we are required, we have mandatory appellate review in death sentences. Pursuant to NRS 177.055 sub 2, and we are to consider whether the evidence supports the finding of an aggravating circumstance or circumstances, which is C, D, whether the sentence of death was imposed under the influence of passion, prejudice, or any arbitrary factors. That second point is the one I'm concerned with. Whether the sentence of death was imposed under the influence of passion, prejudice, or any arbitrary factors, if you would speak to that.
Thank you very much. I don't recall that specific argument, but I'll try to respond to it as far as the
we're responsible to do that per statute.
Okay.
So we have to consider that, and because this argument was made as the wedding, it squares it up, tees it up.
Yes, Justice. It was not based on passion, and my response ties into the bullet. The idea of the fact of the bullet being passed being passion is, in fact, inaccurate. It is factual. That, along with many other factual evidence that came in this case, is the basis upon which the jury can make their determination and made their determination. And so it's not based on passion. It's based on the facts of this case. Sometimes the facts are just so bad that they are very difficult to have to deal with by the defendant and the appellant on review. And so the evidence in this case brought it to that conclusion. And that's my response to that, Justice. There's nothing else. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Westbrook, I'll add 2 minutes to your time so that you can provide the full rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start with giving you the case that I promised you, United States versus Jackson, mm-hmm. 347 F3598, Sixth Circuit case specifically says that at the very minimum, The court should consider evidence of pretext on plain error basis. It's also backed up by Powers, although not directly on that, 499 U.S. at 402. The fact is it has to be, plain error has to be considered, and certainly the Sixth Circuit would agree with that.
What's the page cite on Jackson? I missed it.
I'm sorry, I was speaking quickly because of my time. 347 F3rd 598. It's not a direct quote, but that is the holding of Jackson in regards to this issue. Sixth Circuit, 2003. I want to go to this evidence of maternal trauma and back to Justice Sata's question about the giving birth to a bullet and what's so inflammatory by that. I think it was perfectly illustrated right now by the district attorney. He couldn't even get to the argument without bringing up the issue of whether a fetus is life or not. That is the reason why the state wanted this before the jury, because they wanted the jury to take back to the jury room, not even a murder charge for killing this baby. That's the reason why the imagery of giving birth to the bullet was brought in. And if you want to talk about facts in evidence, the specific findings of their experts was that it was maternal trauma. It was not a bullet striking an unborn child. It was maternal trauma. That is the evidence, not giving birth to a bullet. Excuses made now, trying to explain away the Batson problems, aren't even admissible under the Carnes case.
Counsel, you strung together an argument in the beginning about Batson and sidebars. We're reading the transcription of the argument that was made after the jury was sworn in. Counsel didn't even assert that he had previously objected at sidebar or mention it. I previously asserted this claim. So it's very silent that he had previously objected. So how will we make this leap?
To the extent that there's a discrepancy, Your Honor, but first of all, it's not much of a leap because nobody challenged the timeliness of it. I believe that it would have been challenged.
Wait a second. The transcript, clearly he read the transcript. Is that an incorrect reading of the transcript?
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay, then what the transcript said is the jury was sworn and then the objections were made.
The jury
isn't that just...
Your Honor, the jury was sworn. Well, because there were sidebars that were transcribed. That's the problem.
There's no reference in the objection that's made after the swear ever asserting anything previously. I previously argued anything that would give us that something got said earlier.
That's because the attorneys in this case, as they said in the evidentiary hearing we had to try to complete the record, did not know that the sidebars were not being recorded. They were never told that. There's nothing on the record where they admitted that or were told that. And despite what the state just said, our attorney said the opposite. They did not know the sidebars were not recorded.
Is there any offer of proof made as to what they might have said at the sidebar?
No, there was not, Your Honor. There was not. However, what the state wants to do here is they want to have it both ways. They want to claim that Daniel controls the manner in which objections are recorded and that the defense was required to wait until the next break in trial to make their Batson objections. And then now they want to come up and say that we've somehow waived the objection by not doing it immediately. Well, which is it? What happened is we had a sidebar that was unrecorded because the district court violated Rule 250. And will continue to violate Rule 250 in the future, by the way, because the district court believes that as a reporting court, they don't have to record. This is wrong, and it will continue to happen.
Chief, if I may, a quick question that is right on the issue that Mr. Westbrook is on. If, in fact, there's a purported violation in this particular district courtroom as to 250 compliance, isn't it true, and doesn't the record in this case support, that Judge Herndon came on or stayed on or returned to the bench every single time and asked, counsel, anything for outside the presence, anything for outside the presence? Isn't that a pretty good practice to be sure that everything that needs to be recorded is in fact recorded?
It is a good practice, Your Honor. However, if our attorneys thought that the bench conferences were recorded, then that creates a level of confidence in what the record is going to show, which might have caused them to be sloppy. But if they're sloppy...
Or even the old school that at least comes to my mind from 20 years out of practice, I guess, at this point, is, counsel, anything to add? My response would be, Judge, other than what we said at the record or on the sidebar, or off the record or at the sidebar, nothing to answer. Nothing to add.
And your Honor, frankly, if that destroys the Batson issue in this case, then I think that the conversation I had with Justice Cherry, which I hope was frank enough for the court, should be considered. The final thing that I wanted to add, Your Honor, if I may, is I just heard an argument essentially that two wrongs make a right, and if the defense opens the door to misconduct, then misconduct is okay. Well, we have no case that says that. In fact, Lioce, I believe L-I-O-C-E versus Cohen, says that it's impossible to open the door to misconduct. What happened with the state was misconduct, and nothing that the defense attorney says or does or doesn't do could ever open the door to misconduct, specifically not the kind of misconduct we saw in this case, four pages of a hypothetical wedding that was designed to do nothing but inflame the passions of the jury.
So are we supposed to create a line at the right side of the court now that we send every counsel who violates the rules directly to state bar disciplinary for a hearing? Both sides?
Well, Your Honor, I'm fine with that.
Thank you.
My clients certainly would be fine with that.
I bet your colleague.
I was just going to say
that. I think we've come to an end in this argument, Mr. Westbrook. Mr. Pesci, thank you for your outstanding arguments here today and your excellent briefs. We appreciate it, and the case will stand.